But we've been in a series that we've been talking about ordinary people, extraordinary God, how God uses people in the Bible. It just seems like, you know, mostly unnamed or someone that's not a familiar name to us, and how God uses them in a particular way. And for me, it's a reminder that God can use any of us. And but it really, we're just, you know, in the world's eyes, not special. In our own eyes, just ordinary. But the thing that makes our significance in ministry possible is because we have an extraordinary God. And he can put the right people at the right place, doing the right things with the right heart, and bring things to pass. And we're going to look tonight at one of those. And if you want to look at verse 16 and 23, that'll identify the person. Story in the life of the Apostle Paul. It says, when Paul's sister's son heard of about their ambush, he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Probably for a long time, I didn't even know Paul had a nephew. This is the only named relative of Paul in the entire Bible. We don't know. He had to have a sister, so he had at least one nephew. Maybe there was a whole bunch of nephews and nieces. Maybe there was a whole bunch of children. That seems, you know, they typically would have large families in those days, possible. We don't know whether there was a Mrs. Paul. We don't know whether there was a Paul Jr. We don't know any of those things about him. But this one person, unnamed, just his nephew, his sister's son, steps into the situation, and we'll look at that situation in a little more detail. And if you think about it, he was used of God to do some amazing things that we are the beneficiaries of. So let's just see if we can learn this. And one of the things I think you learn from this passage, this story, is when we think about God's protection or God's miracles, God's care, however you want to say it, they don't always look like they're that miraculous. Sometimes his protection doesn't look miraculous. It just looks ordinary. Because God can use whatever means he has. This story does not have a story of angels coming to rescue Paul. It doesn't have any indication that there's an earthquake that's going to open a jail cell, which had happened earlier in Paul's ministry. There's no prison escape. There is a vision in verse 11, which we'll look at, but there's no major vision of God here. There's no rescue party of disciples with swords. There is no angel of the Lord passing through Jerusalem, like we talked this morning. But nonetheless, this one guy shows up at a key moment to do something special, and God puts all the rest of the pieces together. And I think it's a good reminder to us that God may be using us in ways we don't suspect, or maybe we get a little hint of it once in a while, that we can show up in a certain way at a certain place, a certain time, to just be that voice, that bit of information, that encouragement, that thing that you can accomplish. And we want to be finding those moments in life and trusting that God's at work in our life. Okay, so our title, Acts 23, God's protection doesn't always look miraculous, and we're going to just kind of work our way through this as we can. Just a few basic summary statements I'll get to in just a bit. But let's back up and get the story in general. And actually, this section of the story begins earlier in Acts. Paul was dead set on getting to Jerusalem. He wanted to get to Jerusalem to preach Christ to his people. And God had given him warning that things were not going to go smoothly, to put it mildly. But he was determined to go. I don't know what Paul's thought was. Maybe he was expecting a revival, but instead he runs into a riot. And it becomes very tumultuous. In verse 26 of chapter 21, he was in the temple and he brought some folks there. And anyway, there's this crowd comes and this mob sort of attacks him. He tries to speak to the crowd in verse 37 of chapter 21. And he preaches his story. He gives his testimony. He goes to the part where Jesus encountered him on the way to Damascus and so forth. That's in verses 7 through about verse 11 of chapter 22. And he's preaching that. And then if you look at the very end of this section, verse 21 of chapter 22, he says this. He's describing his story. He says in verse 20 that he was there when Stephen was martyred and was consenting to his death. And he says in 21, then he said to me, God speaking, depart, for I send you far from here to the Gentiles. The reaction. And they listened to him until this word. And then they raised up their voice and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, for he is not fit to live. And they cried out and tore their clothes and threw dust in the air. So you have this big tumult coming. And it says the commander, he was been a Roman commander, we get his name later in chapter 23, sends that somebody's going to come and do something about it. He ordered him to be brought to the barracks so that he should be examined under scourging, so he might know why they shouted so against him. And they bound him with thongs. Paul said to the centurion who stood by, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned?" Uh-oh. They just assumed this was just another rabble-rousing Jews, and this is how they handled them. But he was a Roman citizen. Verse 27, and the commander came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" And he said, "Yes." And the commander answered, "With a large sum I obtained this citizenship." And Paul said, "But I was born a citizen." Immediately those who were about to examine him withdrew from him, and the commander was also afraid after he found out that he was a Roman and because they had bound him. So then they're going to have this kind of conflict with the Sanhedrin and what they're speaking about. That goes in from verse 30 all the way down through these next verses. And Paul pulls out the Roman citizen card. He's about to pull out another card, which I find this interesting. By the way, these are not necessarily divine interventions, but God was giving him the good sense to use what you have. Use what you have. And he's talking about his life story in 23:1-10. And he recognized, it says, verse 7, and when he had said this, verse 6. But when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Men and brethren, I'm a Pharisee, a son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope of the and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged." The Sadducees vehemently did not believe in the resurrection. The Pharisees believed vehemently in the resurrection. So he basically throws this little bomb in the midst of their conversation. He says, "I'm being persecuted because I believe in the resurrection," which is true, the resurrection of Christ. And then suddenly, when he had said this, verse 7, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees, there is no resurrection and no angel or spirit. The Pharisees confessed both. And there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes of the Pharisees' party rose and protested, saying, "We find no evil in this man." If it wasn't so sad, it'd just be hilarious. God's at work. "We find no evil in this man, but if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let's not fight against God." Now there arose a great dissension. The commander, fearing lest Paul might be pulled to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down, take him by force and from among them, and bring them into the barracks. So he's arrested but brought into Roman custody, all right? So first of all, we're going to see this, really the story laying out before us where the nephew comes into play beginning in verse 11, all right? So God's protection, first of all, begins with a promise. It begins with a promise, and this promise you see in verse 11. "But the following night, the Lord stood by him and said, 'Be of good cheer, Paul, for as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, so you must also bear witness in Rome.'" You're going to survive. You're going to get out of this predicament. You're going to go to be a testimony to me in Rome itself. By the way, it's not quite as... It was tumultuous in Jerusalem. It's not much better in Rome, if you want to say it that way. But God wanted this man to do these things, and he saw fit that they would happen. So it says in verse 12, "And when it was day, some of the Jews banded together and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul." Just file that away and see how this works out, okay? Because God had said, "I give you a promise. You're going to accomplish this, and you're not going to die. You're going to get there." And that's what he was leaning on. God has given us great and precious promises. And maybe you've heard this. This is not a promise that you can say chapter and verse on, but I think it's true. You know, until if we're living within his will and God is God, we're really invincible until he's through with us on this planet. He's going to keep us until it's time for our journey, our mission, our ministry, our service to be over, and then we get to go to heaven. What's the negative there, right? I'm going to protect you in this life. I'm going to use you in this life. Now, if we get out of his will, he's able to judge if he wants us and chasten us. And sometimes he may be, what about Ananias and Sapphira? Sometimes God can take someone out prematurely if he wants to. But if we're walking in his will, it's not done until he's done with us. What a great and encouraging reality. So, it says in verse 13, "Now there were more than 40 who had formed this conspiracy. They came to the chief priests and elders and said, 'We have bound ourselves with a great oath, that we will not eat nothing until we have killed Paul. Amen. God bless, right? What a wonderful thing to do. Now, can you get the picture? They kind of get this plot on their own. These 40 guys get together, and they go marching into the council and into the chief priests and the elders, the Sanhedrin. Can we speak? Yes, you can speak. The 40 of us are not going to eat anything, not going to drink anything until we have killed Paul. We are here to present ourselves. If it kills us, if we starve to death, if we get killed in the process, we are so adamant this man must die that we're going to put ourselves on the front line. We're going to put ourselves in harm's way, so to speak. Verse 15. Now you, therefore, together with the council, suggest to the commander that he be brought down to you tomorrow as though you were going to make further inquiries concerning him, but we're ready to kill him before he comes near. So here's the plot. You go to the commander. We're all settled down now. We're going to sort this thing out peaceably and whatever. And while he's making his journey from the barracks to wherever this is probably the place where the Sanhedrin met, these 40 were lying in wait. They were going to pounce on him, and they were going to kill him even if they got killed in the melee. And we're not going to eat anything or drink anything until this takes place. A real threat. A real threat. Now, the nephew enters in verse 16 and following. We'll get to that. But think for a moment, what would have been different? Now, I know God is not limited in what he could do. God could have done this another way. But just from a human standpoint, what if this nephew hadn't have intervened? God hadn't used him there. What if Paul died in Acts 23? First of all, we know that Paul wrote 13 books of the New Testament, 7 of which he wrote after the events of Acts 23. And you think about what that means for us, and some of the books that he wrote after that, I just made a list so I would get it right. Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, Philemon, 1 Timothy, Titus, 2 Timothy. He wrote 13 books of the 27 total in the New Testament, 7 of which are yet to be written when he does that. Now, could God have intervened in other ways? Certainly he could have. But there's something at stake here, something very significant at stake. And what also is at stake is the fact that God had promised that he was going to make it to Rome. He's not going to make it there as a free man, but he's going to make it to Rome. And this is part of that that's taking place. In essence, in verse 11, when God intervenes, he's saying, You preach here, you're going to preach in Rome. It's almost implied. The things you're going to experience next is part of me just getting you there. And that's going to take place. So our protection begins with this promise. We need to understand that. And God is able to bring people into our world, circumstances in our world to protect us. We just need to walk with him. And secondly, God's protection often comes through just very ordinary people in ordinary circumstances. And that's where the nephew comes in. Verse 16 again. So when Paul's sister's son heard their ambush, he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Now, it says that he was, in verse 18, he's described as being a young man. In verse 19, it says the commander took him by the hand. The phrase that's translated from the Greek into the English of young man, it could really be up to maybe into the high 20s. That could be a young man. It could be down into the low teens or maybe even to 10 or 11, 12 years of age. It's a big span. The fact that this, when he's being brought from one place to the other, as it says in 18, verse 19, the commander took him by the hand. Is that just a part of their custom, or was he was just a little boy? I don't know. I just kind of suspect he was on the young side. Why was it he was let in? Probably because he was a relative. That maybe gave him a way in. He was not going to be a threat of his relative, and probably because he was young. He didn't look like an assassin. He comes to that. So God used this very ordinary person, and he introduces us to one of the really overlooked people in the New Testament and does something very, very special. So when Paul's sister's son heard about their ambush, by the way, I wish I knew how he heard. Wouldn't you like to know that? Was he just a servant boy in the Sanhedrin? Maybe he was bringing water and making sure they had everything they need. Maybe he was the guy who had to wash their feet when they came in. Maybe he was sort of like a page when they were doing their official business, carrying documents around. Maybe he just was a passerby and he heard these guys talk. They probably didn't think about trying to keep it secret from him because he's just a kid. And somehow he overhears. Someday we'll hear the rest of this story. I'd love to hear it. But he hears the story. It says, he entered the barracks and told Paul. Verse 17, Then Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, take this young man to the commander, for he has something to tell him. And he took him and brought him to the commander and said, "Paul, the prisoner, called me to him and asked me to bring this young man to you. He has something to say to you." Then the commander took him by the hand, went aside, and asked him privately, "What is it you have to tell me?" Interestingly, God's involved in this. They didn't just dismiss this kid. "Get out of here. We'll take care of this our own way." Or, "What's the hurry? Why are we doing this in this time of day? Just forget this. Just dismiss it." I think he knew something was up. And by the way, the Romans valued above anything else, they wanted everything to be peaceful and quiet and calm. Rebellions and riots and those sort of things were bad. We don't want those things to happen. So we will keep everything calm. And the reason they want to keep everything calm was they want the tax money just to come rolling in. We were going to tax these people. We're going to use them as long as rebellions upset that. They get everything all riled up. We don't want any rebellion. Everything just calm. So they want to calm. He says, verse 19, took him by the hand, went aside and asked him privately, "What is it you have to tell me?" He said, "The Jews have agreed to ask that you bring Paul down to the council tomorrow as though they were going to inquire more fully about him." He gets his attention now. They're trying to fool you. It's not just they're trying to kill Paul, they're trying to fool you. I think they got his attention. "But do not yield to them, for more than 40 of them lie in wait for him, men who bound themselves by an oath that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed him. Now they are ready, waiting for the promise from you." He spills the whole story, and he's there at the right time. Ordinary person, everybody overlooked. Probably, you know, he wasn't a threat to the conspirators. It wasn't until this man kind of heard that he was involved in the plot that his ears perked up, that they were going to abuse this system of bringing him in, and then suddenly everything changes. One person, one place, one overhearing, one trip to the barracks, one story to tell, and everything changed. And it's amazing how dramatically this story shifts, all right? I mean, they probably had a good chance, from an earthly standpoint, to pull this off. I mean, 40 of them. I mean, one of them's going to get through with a knife or a dagger or something. You know, this is a major conspiracy. And Paul would not have been suspecting this attack. So the commander, verse 22, let the young man depart and commanded him, "Tell no one that you've revealed these things to me. Go and be quiet. Go and be quiet." You think of the things that we look at in the Bible of the way what God uses. Well, if you go back through the stories, we did a series a while back on prison stories, and we talked about jailbreaks and those kind of things. We talked about how God intervenes in various ways. Not always does he intervene, but he can do it when he wants to. We need to just take those Bible stories and bring them into our world and say, "Lord, you can and you will, and I trust in you." I was talking to my son late this week, and there's a situation at his work, and he was trying. He said, "I just want to be quiet about it, and I don't want to just. Sometimes I tend to say things I shouldn't say," and so he said, "I want to do that." So I asked him the next time I talked to him on the phone, "How'd it go?" He said, "Well, I feel like the lion in the lion's den with Daniel." "What do you mean, son?" "Well, I think God must have sent an angel and held my mouth shut. That's what I think happened." I'm not sure how good exegesis of that Bible story study that is, or theology, but nonetheless, maybe we need to just go back to the stories. Maybe we need to, "Would you send an angel to hold this mouth shut?" But we need to just take the pictures and the images and the power of the Word of God and say, whatever we're facing, the dangers we face, the things that scare us, the thing that worry us, we need to just take it to the Lord and say, "You're able, and you can intervene, and you can use the most ordinary thing." And it should give us a sense of excitement. Maybe you are the ordinary person this week that's going to stand in a place where just a few words of encouragement is going to keep someone going. Words that are spoken, or a deed that is done, or to show that you care. Or maybe you just pick up a phone and call somebody and say, "You know what, I was just thinking about you. I want to pray with you and let you know you're being thought of today." And if some of you do cards, you send cards to people that are sick and ill and those sorts of things, our homebound folks, don't underestimate, "Oh, it's just a card and a stamp." No, it's far more than that. It's a gift from God. Those of you that teach, and those of you that teach our kids and teach alongside our teens and do other things like that, our musicians, those that sing for us, Don't take that as insignificant. There's something through that that you're probably going to not ever know, but God's using you to bless. You think of the money you put in the offering. Oh, it's not much. There's my check, or there's some money. But you never know. That might be just the amount that's needed somewhere to be part of a whole, to do something significant, to support people like you out there in Montana, and to keep you on the field there and serving God. And as I love what you said, partnering with you, sharing with you in the ministry of the gospel. What a great thing to say. So just be ready. Live with a little expectancy. And if you don't catch what it is that you're doing that's, as an ordinary person, that might be an extraordinary because God's extraordinary, rest assured, there's a lot more going on than you see. He just kind of pulls up the curtain, lets us see a lot of things that's going on here. Now, look at verse 23. You got these 40 guys, right? 40 guys that aren't going to eat or drink. They're going to get really hungry, and they're going to get really thirsty. Because look what it says. And he called for two centurions. So these are like the leaders of a large group of Roman soldiers. Prepare 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at the third hour of the night. Third hour of the night is about 9 p.m. You're going to leave about 9 p.m., going to go through the night. That's 270 soldiers, Roman soldiers, spearmen, and you have these, that, as he says, these 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and off the, I mean, you talk about protection. You know, I mean, suddenly just one little young man says, hey, let me tell you what I heard, and suddenly he has protection the likes of which he never expected, and provide mounts to set Paul on and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. Felix was the governor of Judea. He had the same position that Pontius Pilate had earlier. We know from history that it was about from AD 50-52 to AD 59 that he was the governor there, because we have that through record. So we're in that time frame, probably maybe getting close to the 60-year mark. And Christ was crucified in the early 30s AD, so about 30 years, maybe a few more years after that, depending on how it exactly fell. So he was over in Caesarea, which was on the seacoast. That became the headquarters of the Roman governor. Before that, it was one of the headquarters of Herod, the appointed governor, appointed king of the Jews, so to speak. And Caesarea was beautiful. Herod built a palace there. They built a big hippodrome where they'd have horse racing there. They had all these. This is his palace kind of went out into the sea and was surrounded, had fresh water, even though it was a salt water on the Mediterranean Sea. There was fresh water pools that you could swim in. It was just luxurious. And that's where he was. There's a large amphitheater there. It's been reconstructed even today. So off he goes. So he's going to see Felix, bring him Felix the governor. Verse 25, he wrote a letter in the following manner. Claudius Lysias, so this is that commander that was over things back in Jerusalem. I want you to listen carefully to the letter. Luke somehow gets the details of it, gets it right. But I want you to listen to how, as good a thing as Claudius Lysias does, he tries awfully hard in the letter to make himself look good. It's just human nature, all right? Greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him. Well, you left out the part where we were actually going to put him on the, you know, tie him to a pole and beat him with a, you know, with a whip until he confessed. And then we found out he was a Roman citizen, so we almost goofed up, but we got it just in time. He leaves all that out. Having learned that he was a Roman. Well, that's true as far as it goes. And when I wanted to know the reason they accused him, I brought him before their council. I found out he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him deserving of death or chains. But when it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for him, I sent him immediately to you and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell. So he kind of leaves a couple things out, kind of makes it look good, makes himself the hero, but off he goes. It's interesting that he says this, though. He says, verse 29, concerning questions of their law, I had nothing charged against them deserving of death or chains. By the way, every Roman official that Paul was before declared him innocent. Now, we also know that Caesar eventually condemned him and part of the persecution, and that would have been Nero and so forth. But all the ones that are mentioned in the Bible declared him innocent. In fact, starting in chapter 24, 25 and 26, he spends 2 years in Caesarea. Every time he's allowed to speak before some other official, he just shares the gospel. He spends 2 years of missions work from the inside out in the Roman world. And then finally, then he gets shipped off by a ship to Rome, and you know about the shipwreck and all that sort of thing, and he finally gets there, and you know the rest of that story. But nonetheless, 31. Then the soldiers, as they were commanded, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris, which is about 37 miles away from Jerusalem, so it's roughly halfway. So they get him there, and it's now more friendly territory. It's a place where the Jews were less populous in that area, so that's why it says this one in verse 32. The next day they let the horsemen go on with him and returned to the barracks. So some soldiers were sent back and some continued on. And it says, when they came to Caesarea, that's about another 26 miles from that place, when they get to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they also presented Paul to him. When the governor read it, he asked what province he was from, and when he understood that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will hear you when your accusers have also come. And he commanded him to be kept in Herod's praetorium. Interesting couple things. He asked where he's from, because if he was from a province that this governor was not over, he'd have sent him there for judgment. But Cilicia was not a place that was outside of his realm, so he says, I'll hear your case. And he's kept in Herod's praetorium. Now, probably there was some jail cells in that palace somewhere, but nonetheless, he was in a very safe place. He was a well-cared-for place, and it was a place where he was still doing what Paul always did, was preaching the gospel. So, number three, God's protection sometimes uses very unexpected instruments. You think of where we come from. He's about ready to be beaten to death by the Roman mob. The Romans arrest him. They're gonna whip him to get the story out of him. He finds out he's Roman. He comes in. The nephew steps into the story, reveals the plot. He now gets all this protection from Rome. He gets to a place that for 2 years he's safe as can be, and he just continues to sound out the gospel. One of the things that's interesting, I never thought of this before until I got to studying for this message. One of the things Paul does in all these trials or hearings, I guess you'd say, and he goes before Felix and he goes before some others, it's really Paul laying out the foundation that they all seem to accept that there's nothing illegal or unlawful about the Christian faith in the Roman system. It's just another religion to them. It should have the equal protection or acceptance of Judaism or any other pagan religion. It's legitimate under their law. Therefore, he should not be persecuted. Well, we know that didn't end all the persecution as well, but nonetheless, it builds a very legal framework for the reality of Christianity. So this man, this commander, and also Felix, as you would read later, you'd see about it. 5 days, by the way, Ananias the high priest came down, and that's chapter 24, and you could read the rest of the story if you'd like. But this commander acted immediately. What if he just said, let's wait till tomorrow. Right now, mount up the horses and get the men together and all this protection, just get there now. And he writes the letter, so at least we'll get the entrance in. He assembled a very extraordinary military escort, and the irony was almost humorous. They were marching with the full protection of Rome, all these men, to a very safe place, a safe harbor, a very comfortable place if you're going to be in prison. And these guys never, ever got off a go with their plot. Wouldn't you like to know what time they went back to eating and drinking? I don't think any of them did a hunger fast, hunger strike, and killed themselves. But God just saw to it that their plans are upturned. And God, in his wisdom, can turn the plans against us as God's people, even Satan himself, and can turn them upside down. And the irony is very much on display. And that really, in some cases, humor is on display. So, and also the Jewish leaders wanted Paul dead, but the government wanted order. That was true. And it was the first step in Paul on his way to Rome, where God said back in verse 11 that that's where he was heading. There's a story told about a young girl that was watching her grandmother weaving fabric together to make a tapestry. From standing on the floor, the child could only look up at the bottom of this tapestry, and all she saw was collars and strings hanging down. It just didn't look like much from that point of view. Finally, she asked her grandmother, "What are you making? It doesn't look beautiful at all." And she invited her to lift her up to look at it from the other side. She saw the beautiful intricate pattern woven together, and it was remarkably beautiful. Sometimes we're like looking at God's tapestry from the bottom. It looks a little bit disorganized. It looks a little bit not good. It doesn't seem to fit together in any discernible pattern. But from God's vantage point, he's weaving it all together. And he will protect you through ordinary means or extraordinary means, or use ordinary people, because he's an extraordinary God. He protects us along the way. In this scary world, find some comfort in that. God might just have a nephew of yours to step in and be a blessing to you. Maybe someone else. Maybe it's a total stranger, but God is able. Rest in him. Hope that encourages you tonight. Let's pray.